All right. I'm coming. Jesus.
Merry Christmas!
Ah, shit.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe hung where you can see every couple tries to stop. Rocking around the Christmas tree, let the Christmas spirit ring.
It's the Christmas show, episode 198 of the Sound Off here on SCScoops.com. Sunday, December 25th, 2011, I am the Solemn Monster. Hope everybody who celebrates is having a very Merry Christmas and got what they wanted from Santa under the tree this morning when they woke up. For those of you who do not celebrate Christmas, this is, after all, the holiday season. I want to wish all of our Jewish listeners out there a very happy Hanukkah. I believe tonight is night number 5 of 8 for Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa, for those of you who may celebrate that. For me, Christmas is never complete until I've had a chance to watch Jingle All the Way on cable. Usually they just blast this movie on all the different channels. And I have not seen this movie at all this weekend. So to me, I feel somewhat incomplete here during this Christmas weekend. Hopefully I will see Arnold and Sinbad and Big Show on my screen sometime later this evening. And to celebrate the Christmas season, of course, I do have a beverage here with me for the show, the usual. Anybody who knows me, have myself a Jack and Coke here at the desk. This should be a fun time here. We're going to talk about TLC. We're going to talk about Raw from Monday night, a show that I very much enjoyed, although apparently not everybody did since they turned out in droves. And we'll talk about all that and a whole bunch of other stuff. Let's just kick things off here with the TLC pay-per-view last weekend. WWE, of course, ending 2011. Their pay-per-view business this year has not been very good. And we'll talk about the Survivor Series buy rate as well here in a little bit. TLC was a show that, as I mentioned last week, I did not plan on watching. I certainly was not going to plunk down money for it. And I believe I also said that this is the kind of show that has the potential to be a sleeper hit, if you will. On paper, it had some good matches, but it didn't look terribly strong. It seemed like a very lame duck kind of show. I certainly didn't expect there to be any significant title changes. Obviously, I was wrong about that. But what I was not wrong about is that this show actually turned out to be pretty good, all things considered. There was some pretty good action on this show. I did have a chance to see it with a friend, as it turned out. I did watch the pay-per-view, so I can give some thoughts on the show. I will say, I was correct in all but one of my predictions. Not a bad batting average to have. I was only wrong about the World Heavyweight Championship match, which we'll talk about here in a second. And who would have thought that when this show was over, we would have two former Ring of Honor champions representing WWE as its respective champs? That's certainly something that you go back even a couple of months, and I don't know that anybody on the planet could have predicted that this would happen this quickly, that CM Punk and Daniel Bryan would end 2011 as WWE's world champions for Raw and SmackDown. Pretty impressive stuff, all things considered. I don't know where they go from here, but for now, for one night, it was actually a pretty cool thing. Just go match by match here. Show started out pretty hot. One of the hottest opening matches I've seen on a WWE pay-per-view in quite some time. Zack Ryder did, in fact, beat Dolph Ziggler, as I predicted, to win the U.S. Championship. Place went nuts. Zack's dad, the Big O, both in the audience. Anybody who watches his YouTube show knows who the Big O is. And again, I personally would have held out until a bigger event to give Ryder the title. But if they were going to do the match here, it was really the only outcome that made sense. I think if Ryder would have had the match and lost clean, it would have stalled his momentum big time. So I was happy to see him win the championship. And they really played it up as something big. You know, they really played it up as something special. There was a very long post-match celebration. They showed him holding the belt, celebrating with his dad at ringside, walking back up the aisle. They didn't just cut away. They really tried to make it seem like it was a big deal. I can't remember the last time they did something like that for a U.S. championship feud or even an intercontinental championship feud. So this was really cool to see. And they threw a couple of matches on the show unannounced. Now, they've done this before. WWE will go on the air and they'll announce a match or even two matches that were not previously announced. I can't remember a pay-per-view where they actually went on the air and they had three unannounced matches that they just threw onto the show at the last minute. I mean, if that doesn't tell you right there what they thought of the show, then I don't know what does. And Air Boom was one of the matches. They defeated Primo and Epico, who had Rosa Mendez at ringside in their corner. Of course, the thing about Primo and Epico, they're very good workers. They work well together. And it's great to see more tag teams in WWE. This is all about Rosa. I mean, they had so many shots of Rosa at ringside, and you hear her cheering them on in Spanish, and clearly she's the gimmick here to try to get these guys over. Or maybe they're using Primo and Epico to try to get Rosa over. You know, wouldn't surprise me if that was really what their goal here was. But Air Boom beat them, retained the tag team titles. Pretty good match. Randy Orton defeated Wade Barrett in a tables match, as I predicted he would. Pretty cool finish. I thought it was a bit botched at first. I don't know that it was botched. Barrett got put through a table here at the end, and it was more so his knees. He came off the ropes. Orton rolled off the table. Barrett had laid him across it, and Orton rolled off, caught him with an RKO coming off the top, and or the second rope, I believe, and it was more so Barrett's knees that went through the table, but hey, he went through the table. That's all that matters, and Orton wins. It seemed as though this perhaps was the blow-off to their feud, but as we would find out the next night, in fact, it was not. Beth Phoenix, another unannounced match. The women's champion beat Kelly Kelly here. Really not much to this. Triple H and Kevin Nash had their sledgehammer ladder match. And, boy, Triple H, you know, it's been said that there are people that can, you know, wrestle a broomstick and have a good match. You know, people said that about Ric Flair in his prime. People said that about Shawn Michaels, quite frankly, up until the day he retired at the age of 45 or 46, whatever he is. Triple H has had some really great matches in his career. A lot of times he's had great matches with great workers, and he's had pretty great matches with workers who were not so great. But Triple H is by no means a miracle worker the likes of Shawn Michaels or Ric Flair. I know he's good friends with both. I know he probably likes to think he's a lot bigger than he actually is. You know, we first saw that when Triple H had that match with Vladimir Kozlov at Survivor Series a couple of years ago. You know, Triple H had a SummerSlam pay-per-view match, if I remember correctly, for the championship with the Great Khali. And I'll give Triple H, you know, I'll cut him some slack there. Great Khali, who can possibly get a great match out of the Great Khali? But nonetheless, Triple H has had some matches with people who needed a lot of help. And, you know, the end result has not been that great. So here he gets in the ring with Kevin Nash, who obviously is way past his prime. I mean, Nash's knees are gone. I don't even think he has knees anymore. He has nubs. And Triple H beat Kevin Nash, which, as I said, had to be the end result. I mean, how much longer could you drag this feud out for, number one? And number two, clearly they're grooming Triple H now for a match with The Undertaker at WrestleMania. So Triple H needs to look strong. Kevin Nash is more of a transitional feud, much like John Cena and Kane. Kane is more of a transitional feud for Cena before he faces The Rock at WrestleMania. So Triple H did win here. He won decisively, attacking Kevin Nash at the end with the sledgehammer, laying him out. Nash did a stretcher job. They put a neck brace on him. They carried him out. They teased that perhaps this was the end of Kevin Nash. And in fact, it does appear as though the end of Kevin Nash has come. His full-time in-ring active career as a wrestler appears to be over. And I'm going to talk about Kevin Nash here in just a moment. I'll talk a little bit more about it. As for the match itself, not very good at all. I think Triple H did what he could. Triple H came into this match physically not in the best of shape either. He looked a little, how shall I say, puffy. Let's just put it that way. Now, granted, the guy is not a full-time wrestler anymore. He's 40-something years old. He's more of an executive now than a wrestler. But still, yeah, Triple H is not exactly in his prime either. They did what they could. I mean, even Kevin Nash, I'll give him credit. Kevin Nash did everything that he could, which wasn't much, because the guy can barely move. And the fact that they would put Kevin Nash in a ladder match, again, is something that boggled my mind. I will give Kevin Nash credit for one thing. Kevin Nash took a bump in this match. You know, Triple H worked over his knees quite a bit, but he took one big bump towards the end of the match where both men were climbing the ladder simultaneously, one on each side, trying to reach up for the sledgehammer. And there was a table that was strategically placed in the ring earlier on. And Triple H grabbed hold of the sledgehammer, which was still hanging from the ceiling, and kind of pushed it right into Kevin Nash's head. And Kevin Nash took a bump off the ladder through the table down below. So it was as safe a bump as you could possibly take from the ladder. Not exactly anything close to what Ricardo Rodriguez did later on in the show. But I'll give Kevin Nash a lot of credit for taking that bump. I didn't even think he would do that. And anytime you climb a ladder, 10, 15 feet in the air, 8 feet in the air, whatever it is, and you're a guy as big as he is and you've had injuries and knee problems like he has, just to climb that ladder and take any sort of bump, you got my respect. That's not an easy thing to do. So he did take that bump. Unfortunately, he did botch the first pedigree attempt. It reminded me of Triple H once tried to pedigree Vince McMahon on Raw when Triple H, this was after Triple H had come back as a babyface from his first quad tear in 2002. Him and Stephanie were on Raw renewing their wedding vows. That was when they officially broke up. And I believe it was in that segment that Triple H tried to pedigree Vince McMahon the first time. And Vince basically, when Triple H kind of moves his body, like right before he goes to jump, I think people sometimes think, oh, he already jumped, so I have to jump. And Vince jumped too early, and it looked really bad. And that's exactly what happened here. Kevin Nash kind of went too early, completely botched the move. Michael Cole tried to cover for it by saying his knee gave out, which was kind of clever on his part. You know, you can say his knee gave out or he tried to escape. And Triple H tried again, nailed the pedigree, finished him off with a sledgehammer shot to the head. And 1-2-3, that was the end of Kevin Nash. They did what they could, but this match was just no good. Sheamus beat Jack Swagger in another unannounced match. Third one on this show. Kind of pointless. Sheamus beat him, I believe, with the brogue kick. 1-2-3, nothing more to this. Big Show beat Mark Henry to win the World Heavyweight Championship. And if you would have told me that that was going to be the end result going in, I would have just hung my head in shame. And as it turns out, Mark Henry has a very serious groin injury. I don't know if it's a serious pull, if he possibly tore his groin. Groin injuries, let me tell you, are no fun. I have never torn my groin, but I have pulled it, and it is not a fun injury. And so because of that injury, Mark Henry was very limited in what he could do in this match. They didn't really do much of anything. The match went maybe 5 minutes. Big Show beat him clean with a knockout punch, 1-2-3, new World Heavyweight Champion. The crowd wanted Daniel Bryan to come down and cash in, and that's exactly what happened. Daniel Bryan comes down to the ring, cashes in on Big Show, who had been laid out after the match by Mark Henry. And so he was down and vulnerable. Daniel Bryan comes out, cashes in, 1-2-3, new World Heavyweight Champion. And, you know, not quite as impactful as it would have been if they actually would have waited and had Daniel Bryan cash in at WrestleMania, as he said he would do. But you know what? It plays into the story, because just a couple of weeks ago on SmackDown, it was Big Show who literally had to prop up Daniel Bryan and try to convince him to cash in his Money in the Bank on Mark Henry. Unfortunately, Mark Henry got up before Daniel Bryan had the ability to pin him and beat Daniel Bryan down. He never did get a chance to cash in. But, you know, Big Show was the one who tried to convince him, listen, you got to take advantage of every opportunity that comes your way. Don't wait until WrestleMania. If you have a chance to cash in, then you've got to cash in and do what you got to do. And that's exactly what Daniel Bryan did. He took Big Show's advice, and unfortunately, it bit Big Show on his big ass. And I thought that's actually quite a clever story for them to tell. So, anyway, Daniel Bryan wins the championship. The place goes nuts. He just is full of emotion, jumps up on the announce table, gets in Michael Cole's face. Cole has this priceless expression on his face. And this was great stuff. It was an emotional, you know, win. Daniel Bryan has for many years now been regarded as one of the greatest wrestlers in the world. You know, he made a name for himself on the independent circuit, had just five-star match after five-star match. He may not be much to look at. I know there's some people who look at him and go, this guy's a world champion. We have a couple of people who listen to the show, including one lovely lady who knows who she is, who just hates his guts, just hates Daniel Bryan's guts. I'm not sure if he goes heel, if maybe she might warm up to him. Some people just don't like him. He doesn't look like a world champion. He looks too small. He looks too nice. He's not all big and jacked up and all that. It'll be an adjustment period. People are just going to have to get used to it. If you want a real wrestler as a world champion, this is as close to a real wrestler as you're going to get. And you know, no greater endorsement does he get than from Shawn Michaels and William Regal after the show, who said they called to congratulate him. Well, you've got guys like Shawn Michaels, who helped train him, and William Regal, who helped train him, singing this guy's praises. To me, you can get no better endorsement than workers like that. So congratulations to Daniel Bryan. Really happy for him. I don't know how long it's going to last, but for now, he is a World Heavyweight Champion, and he deserves it. Cody Rhodes beat Booker T on the show to retain the Intercontinental title. Cody attacked Booker twice earlier in the show, finally they were able to get the match started, and Cody beat him, which was really, I mean, the only outcome here. I don't know if this is going to continue, if this was a one-and-done kind of blow-off here to this program. The whole point of putting Booker with Cody was to help Cody get over. I don't know how you help Cody get over by having Booker beat him and take his title. So, thankfully, they did not go that route. Cody beat him clean, 1-2-3, looks very strong in the process. Cody Rhodes is on his way up. They are pushing him quite hard of late, and that's a good thing. And then the main event, TLC, CM Punk retaining his WWE Championship over The Miz and Alberto Del Rio. This was actually a great match. I really did enjoy this match quite a bit. I thought they all worked very well together. The fans seemed to be into it. It was a little weird not having John Cena out there. It was very unique. This was the first time in maybe years that they've truly given another main event babyface the ball to run with. And there was no John Cena around. You know, John Cena was not part of the show at all. He was backstage. He did not appear on camera. He did not get added to this match at the last minute. This was Punk's main event. This was his chance to sink or swim. And he did a hell of a job in this match. I'm sure the buy rate won't be much to look at, and certainly the Raw ratings of late have been a bit troublesome. But, I mean, what more can the guy do? He's going out there. He's putting on great matches. The fans seem to be into him. The big spot here in this match came courtesy of Ricardo Rodriguez, who tried to interfere on Del Rio's behalf. I believe he was climbing the ladder to try to pull the title down for Del Rio. And, of course, he got caught. He got stuck at the top of the ladder. Miz and Punk grabbed a hold of the ladder, and they slowly tipped the ladder over. I mean, it was slow motion here, which probably made it even scarier for Ricardo. I don't know if he's afraid of heights or not, but he had a lot of time to think about what was about to happen to him. He got tipped over and fell, I don't even know. I mean, he must have fallen 12 to 15 feet from the top of this ladder, and he took a dive outside the ring. There were two tables set up on the outside, and he completely overshot one table, but thankfully he did hit the other one. I say thankfully, but in reality, if you go back and watch that bump, I really don't think that table broke his fall at all. I mean, he just crashed through that table and just hit the arena floor in a heap. Two referees rushed over to check on him, gave the sign that all was okay, but he took a hell of a bump. And apparently backstage after the show, he was kind of the talk of the town. A lot of people talking about that bump that he took. A lot of respect earned, I think, this night for Ricardo Rodriguez. Hopefully we get to see more of him. He is a wrestler, for those of you who don't know. He competes down in Florida Championship Wrestling. And I think we need to see more Ricardo on TV, not less. Although I would expect him perhaps to be off TV for another week or two, maybe, to sell the bump. And anyway, the big spot at the end here, there were handcuffs that had been introduced into the match earlier on. Punk had been handcuffed. He had broken free. But Miz then handcuffed CM Punk to the middle ring rope. It was actually in the corner by the post. And it looked as though Punk was doomed. He had no way to escape. Miz or Del Rio most certainly would be able to climb the ladder and take the championship. And then had a pretty cool spot here where Punk basically undid the ring rope, which is not an easy thing to do with your bare hands. Normally when they put the ring together, they have people who have tools that they use to do that sort of thing. But Punk apparently has hands of steel and managed to undo the second rope, escaped. And in the end, Punk retains the championship, pulls the title down, and everybody goes nuts. This was a fine end to the show, a great main event. And overall, a pretty good pay-per-view. Not perfect, but a pretty good pay-per-view, which, again, kind of a shame. I'm sure a lot of people didn't see it. Certainly a lot of people didn't pay for it. That seems to be the pattern, because WWE going into these shows doesn't give people a reason to want to plunk down $40 or $50. And sometimes you'll get really crappy shows, and sometimes you'll get a show that actually does pretty well for itself. And I'd say TLC was a pretty good show overall. And back to Kevin Nash here. As I said, Kevin Nash appears to be done. He even went on Twitter a day or two after the pay-per-view and made a comment to the effect of, you know, he mentioned Triple H by his real name, Paul, and said that it was an honor if he had to go out for him to go out against one of his best friends. And the talk seems to be that Kevin Nash is, in fact, retired as an in-ring performer. Now, again, we know how these wrestling retirements go. And Kevin Nash has done quite a few matches on the independent circuit in recent years. So it wouldn't shock me if Kevin Nash still does Indeed 8s from time to time. Maybe in a year or two, WWE wants to bring him in for some sort of TV match. I don't think we've seen the last of Kevin Nash in the ring, but for all intents and purposes, his in-ring career is over. And it got me to thinking, you know, I know I've been hard I'm Big Kev these past few months. I've cracked jokes at his expense. I've poked fun at him and all that. So I figured, you know, in the spirit of the Christmas season here, after all, this is the Christmas show, and in honor of his retirement from the Squared Circle, I thought that I would rank Kevin Nash's top five greatest matches. Matches that, whether it's a singles match, a tag match, a match that he was involved in, I figured, let me rack my brain to see if I can come up with even five. I didn't even know if I was going to be able to come up with five. But I racked my brain and I racked my brain, and I came up with five matches that, in my opinion, are among the best that Kevin Nash has ever been a part of. In no particular order. Number five, we'll start from the bottom, I guess. Actually, I guess this is kind of in order, but you can pretty much mix and match these matches. Everybody has their own opinion. Number five, I would put the Royal Rumble in 1994 on this list. Not that it was a great Rumble. In fact, the 94 Rumble was not, in my opinion, among the best Rumbles. But this was really a star-making match for Kevin Nash. This was back when he was still Shawn Michaels' bodyguard, Big Daddy Cool Diesel, first really coming into his own and starting to get more ring time. And Nash came into the Royal Rumble on this night and was just a monster. I mean, he eliminated, offhand, I don't remember exactly how many people. He must have eliminated anywhere from six or seven people. One right after the other. I mean, Owen Hart came in, threw Owen Hart out. Virgil came in, threw him out. Bob Backlund came in, threw him out. Just one after the other after the other. And the place was going nuts. People were chanting for Diesel, Diesel. I mean, this guy was over on this night. This was a star-making night for him. And in the end, he did get dumped out of the ring, but people took notice of the Diesel character on this night. He looked very impressive in this match. So I'd put the Royal Rumble 1994 on any list. I think this was a pivotal night in the career of Kevin Nash. Number four, WrestleMania 12. Diesel against The Undertaker. This was one of Nash's last big matches in WWE during his first run. Of course, he had one more pay-per-view match the next month. And the month after that, he went to WCW. And WrestleMania 12, you know, Undertaker had some pretty goddamn awful matches early in his WrestleMania run. In fact, I don't know that Undertaker really had a good WrestleMania match until the match with Diesel at WrestleMania 12. And Nash deserves some of the credit for that. I don't know that going into the match you expected two big guys to have as good of a match as they had. They had a pretty good match, all things considered. Nash has always had knee problems. I mean, Nash has knee problems going back to when he used to play basketball. So when Nash first came into wrestling in the early 90s, he already had knee issues. So you cut the guy a little bit of slack. His mobility has always been questionable. He's never been a great worker. But he's always been a pretty good big man. I don't know. I wouldn't say that Nash deserves to be ranked as one of the best big men in wrestling history. You know, if I put a list together of the best big men, either really tall guys or really heavy guys, who were very agile or quick or just very, very good workers, perhaps when you didn't expect them to be, you know, honestly, at the top of anyone's list, you'd have to either put Vader in his prime or The Undertaker. The Undertaker's like a fine wine in a lot of ways. He seems to only get better with age. Undertaker had a lot of god-awful matches early in his career. And a lot of that wasn't his fault. It was just who they programmed him with. And back then, Undertaker really wasn't able to sell much. It was part of his gimmick. But Undertaker has had some phenomenal matches as he's gotten older. Vader had a very forgetful run. Very forgettable run in WWF in 1996. He was heavier than he used to be. He just wasn't as good in the ring. People knocked his work constantly. They never did give him the championship, in part because of that. He was somewhat of a disappointment. But if you go back and watch Vader in his prime from the Big Van Vader days, you know, the early 90s in WCW, 92, 93, Vader was a phenomenal worker. Just absolutely phenomenal. And for a legit 450-pound man, for him to be as quick in the ring as he was and pull off moonsaults and just have four-star matches as often as he had, it's quite the amazing thing. I mean, he had matches like that with Ric Flair, with Sting, with the British Bulldog, guys who were not the best of workers. So to me, you make a list of the best big men in wrestling history. Guys like Vader, guys like The Undertaker have to be at the top. Bam Bam Bigelow, guys like that. Kane, I would even put Kane in that camp. Kevin Nash is not a man that I would put on that list. Certainly not in the top five or even the top 10. But WrestleMania 12, him and Undertaker had a very good big man match. Very good match. And I think that deserves to be mentioned here. But like I said, Undertaker had matches with Jimmy Snuka, with Giant Gonzalez, for crying out loud, with King Kong Bundy. Undertaker's WrestleMania streak is a little bit less impressive when you think about the steps that he was in the ring with back then. And I really think that match with Diesel was his first really good WrestleMania match. Number three on the list is a tag team match that I would urge anybody who has never seen this match needs to go on YouTube or Daily Motion. I know this match is out there. Find it and watch it. It's at least 20 minutes long. It is a great, great, in my opinion, underrated match. It was a tag team match that aired on WWF's old Action Zone show. This show used to air on Sunday mornings on USA. It aired on October 30th, 1994. I think it was taped the month before, but it aired on the 30th back in 94. And it was Diesel and Shawn Michaels against Razor Ramon and the 1-2-3 Kid. All four members of the Click, sans Triple H, obviously, were in this match. And this was a hell of a tag team match. Everybody played their role perfectly. We know that Waltman is obviously a great worker. Shawn Michaels, one of the best workers of all time. Scott Hall, back in the day, before he let his demons get to him, was a pretty damn good worker himself. And then you had Nash. Now, of the four guys in this match, Diesel was obviously the worst. But in this match, he wasn't really bad. He played his role perfectly. He wasn't in there, it was in a tag team match. I think that's perfect for him because he doesn't have to be in there the whole time. So he would tag in and tag out. As a tag team match, this had everything. It had great action. It went back and forth. There was some really fast-paced stuff going on. It had length. It was long. This was just a great fucking match. I mean, it's a match that some people probably have never even seen before. So Diesel and Shawn against Razor and the 1-2-3 Kid from Action Zone in 94. Look for it. It is a really, really great match. Survivor Series 1995, his match with Bret Hart, I'd put it number two on this list. Bret Hart took Diesel to perhaps one of, if not the greatest singles match he's ever had. On this list, I'm putting it at number two. Now, Bret and Diesel had a lot of matches back in the day. Their first big match on pay-per-view was at the King of the Ring in 1994. And I watched that match recently, and that match does not, it has not aged well. I know that Diesel was actually hurt at the time. He actually, I believe he had a knee injury, and he could actually barely move. Which actually, you know, makes his performance in that match all the more impressive. But they had a match at the King of the Ring in 94. It was Intercontinental Champion Diesel against the WWF Champion Bret Hart for the WWF title. And this was when Jim the Anvil Neidhart was brought back that night and ended up turning heel. Anyway, they had a match in 94. It wasn't that good. The next match they had was at the Royal Rumble in 1995. By this point, Diesel was the champion. Both guys were babyfaces. They had a match. It was pretty good. Not as good as their Survivor Series match, but pretty good. Then came the Survivor Series match, the so-called rubber match in this feud, and this was a no holds barred match if I remember correctly. This was the night that Bret won the championship back from Diesel, ending Diesel's year long stranglehold on the title. By the way, when Diesel was champion, business bombed, so Bret took the title back on this night, but he took Diesel to a hell of a match. And this was also the match with the first big table bump in WWE history. This was the earliest table bump I could remember. Towards the end of the match, Bret was outside, jumped up onto the apron to try to come back in, and Diesel came at him, grabbed the ropes, and basically with the force of the ropes, the momentum of the ropes, shoved Bret off the apron, and Bret just flew through the air and crashed through the Spanish announce table. And back then, the announce tables were very basic wooden tables. There was nothing really to them. And Bret took a bump through the table, and it was like, wow. I mean, unless you were a fan of the original ECW, you'd already seen stuff like this. This was a pretty cool spot that they clearly stole from ECW, by the way. In the end, Bret wins. Diesel goes heel after the match, beats up Bret Hart, beats up a couple of referees. This was one of his best matches, and deserves to be mentioned, because again, it takes two to tango. Bret can go in there and have a great match with a guy, but the other guy has to be able to perform. And Diesel had a hell of a match on this night. And to me, the number one match on any Kevin Nash list in terms of singles matches has to be his In Your House match, which was his final WWF pay-per-view match before going to WCW. Now, mind you, they knew in February of 96 that Nash was going to Atlanta. And he lost to The Undertaker at WrestleMania, and yet the next month he got a title match because Shawn Michaels won the championship, and they wanted to basically help put Shawn over because they knew Diesel would do the job for him. Diesel was on the way out anyway. And so they had a match, Shawn Michaels versus Diesel. It was a no-holds-barred match at the Good Friends, Better Enemies in Your House pay-per-view. And this was a great brawl. This was a match that was clearly designed because there were people who questioned the toughness of Shawn Michaels, you know, putting the title on him. And here's a guy who comes to the ring dressed the way that he's dressed and he dances around. This guy's not tough. It's kind of the same things that people say about The Miz these days. And this match was clearly designed to show a tough side of Shawn Michaels, to show that Shawn Michaels is not just flash and not just aerial moves and all that kind of stuff, but he can go in there and he can get down and dirty with the best of them. And it was a hell of a brawl. And one of the more memorable spots from this match was Diesel attacking Mad Dog Vachon, who was in the front row, legend, of course, attacking him and ripping off his fake leg. He had been in an auto accident some years earlier and had a prosthetic leg. And in this spot, you know, and credit to Vachon for agreeing to go through with this, Diesel ripped his leg off. And it was a pretty intense spot. You know, some people questioned WWF's taste for doing it. I thought it was pretty cool. And Diesel brought the leg into the ring. He tried to use it as a weapon. Shawn Michaels kicked him in the crotch. Shawn Michaels ended up using him, the role model that he was, ended up using the leg as a weapon, and then he super kicked Diesel, pinned him, and that was pretty much the end of it. Shawn looked like $1 million in this match. Diesel played his role perfectly. This was a great match, and in my opinion, the greatest match that he ever had, and he had it with his best friend. So, again, Nash has had some pretty good matches. When you really stop and look at it, yes, he's not a great worker, but that's fine. Not everybody is. Give credit where credit is due. He's had some pretty good matches in his career. And when it comes to a discussion of the Hall of Fame, you know, is Kevin Nash worthy of being in the Hall of Fame? It's kind of a funny thing to ask because what is the Hall of Fame? In many ways, it's a sham. You know, it's a figment of Vince McMahon's imagination. Depending on what side of the bed he rolls out of on any given day, you could either be inducted into the Hall of Fame or not be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Considering some of the other guys that are in there, like Coco Beware, who was a great worker, all due respect, Greg the Hammer Valentine, Nikolai Volkoff, I'd say Kevin Nash is pretty much a shoe-in for the Hall of Fame. When you look at the totality of his career, like I said, he's had some great matches, but you can't deny the impact he had with the NWO angle. You know, yes, he got lucky. Nash got lucky. You know, his contract came due. He wanted to make more money. He jumped to WCW. Eric Bischoff stole the idea from New Japan, decided to bring the NWO concept over to WCW to pretend as though there was an actual WWF invasion going on. It got people talking, and Nash and Hall were you know, the beneficiaries of it. They were the beneficiaries of being part of one of the greatest, well-orchestrated, well-timed angles in the history of United States wrestling, quite frankly. But, you know, Nash, for a large part of his career, has been a main eventer. He's been, you know, one of the biggest stars. Whatever company he's been in, he's managed to be one of the biggest stars there. Say what you want to about him and his politicking and all that. But is Kevin Nash Hall of Fame worthy? Yeah, I'd say Kevin Nash is Hall of Fame worthy, absolutely. And I'd say if his career really is over, it won't be very long before we see him in the Hall of Fame, maybe next year or the year after that. So, anyway, that was my thoughts on the career of Kevin Nash and his apparent final match with Triple H. Not a great match to go out on, but he did everything he could. I mean, he really did. There was nothing more that Kevin Nash could have done. He took a big bump. You know, what more can you really say? Let's talk about Monday Night Raw here from Monday night. We'll go through the good, the bad, and the ugly here in a second. This show on Monday night was a huge upgrade from last week's show. This one I really enjoyed, and it felt like an important show going forward for a company all too often criticized for being stuck in the past. You know, they're actually pushing new guys for a change, and I commend them for that. You know, I salute WWE for that. CM Punk actually tweeted a photo, all of you have seen it by now, prior to the show, he tweeted a photo of WWE's Champions Roll Call. It's a photo of all the champions gathered together backstage, and you know, he said that if you can't get behind this, then be prepared to be left behind. And the only other person missing from that photo op, in my opinion, was Dolph Ziggler. Dolph Ziggler is also part of that nucleus of young guys that are going to help carry this company and are going to be big stars in the future. And it was just a really cool visual. And, you know, this show in some ways felt like that Raw show the night after WrestleMania 14, when the Austin era officially kicked off. That was the night after Steve Austin won the WWF title for the first time. Vince McMahon introduced him. Austin came to the ring. He swapped out the old Winged Eagle belt, which I dearly miss, for the new championship belt. And it just felt like this was the start of a new era. And granted, you know, the crowd that night was a lot hotter than it was on this night in Philadelphia. But still, you get the point. And for what it's worth, on that note, people in the building did say that the fans were a lot louder in person than they came across on TV. But it still has to be said that the Philly crowd, it disappointed me a bit. You know, it just didn't seem like they were as into the show as perhaps they should have been. In any event, I can't really complain, quite frankly, about a show that includes CM Punk, Daniel Bryan, and Zack Ryder as champions in the main event. I know not everybody is a Zack Ryder fan, and not everybody is a Daniel Bryan fan. There's been a lot of Daniel Bryan hatred that has come out ever since he won the championship. Haters gonna hate, I guess, but I can't complain about this at all. I'm not saying I liked everything about this show on Monday, but really, the main things I enjoyed on this show were Kane's beatdown of John Cena and the main event. But when the show was over, I was entertained, and it felt, you know, I felt optimistic heading into 2012. I you know, granted, there is one more Raw show left before the end of the year, but I don't expect any significant happenings until that January 2nd show. So let's talk about the good on this show. Here's something I haven't been able to say for a while. I really like the opening segment on Raw. They actually tried to make their title seem important, and it's going to take a lot longer than 1 week to do that, granted, but I like that they tried. You know, seeing Punk and Bryan together in the ring, each with a world title, it brought back memories of Benoit and Guerrero at WrestleMania 20. And let's hope that that's where the comparison ends for their sake. But, you know, Ryder is getting more over with the fans each and every week, which is encouraging to see that they haven't turned on him just yet. I mean, give it time. They will turn on him. It's just inevitable that it will happen. But I just thought this opening segment was great. You know, it looked like they were ushering in a new era. It was nice to see some different faces other than John Cena or Triple H or any of the usual cast of characters in the opening segment. So thumbs up on that. Randy Orton and Wade Barrett had a rematch from their tables match the night prior. This time it was just a straight singles match, which sounds like something TNA would do, quite frankly. And this match was good for what it was. You know, it wasn't terribly long or anything like that. But Barrett thumbed him in the eye for the DQ at the end and then put him through a table. So apparently this feud is going to continue, and we'll see where they go with that. I thought the John Cena promo was pretty bad, but I'll get to that in a second. Kane coming out and trying to smother Cena into unconsciousness was one of my favorite parts of the entire show. He even made him bleed a little bit from the mouth. You know, then he ripped Cena's shirt off, which was pre-ripped, by the way. As soon as I saw a rip in the top of Cena's shirt when he first came out, I knew it was going to be ripped off by somebody. A little too obvious there. I mean, come on. Hulk Hogan never needed his shirts to be pre-ripped. You kidding me? I mean, granted, he had holes ripped in the back of the shirt, but not in the top of the shirt. I mean, come on. Primo and Epico beat the Usos in a pretty good match. I like this. The focus was clearly on Rosa Mendez again outside the ring, and the crowd could not have cared less about the Usos because they haven't been on Raw in ages. But I thought the action here was pretty good. Nice old-school tag team action. Nothing wrong with this. Here's a question I have for you. Since when did Josh Matthews grow some balls? Big Show tries to... he does a promo backstage, and he tries to convince the audience that he doesn't blame Daniel Bryan for cashing in on him the night before. And everything is cool. And while his face would clearly dictate that things are, in fact, not cool, and instead of just letting it go, Matthews, you know, gets up in his face and actually points out that, you know, you don't look like you're cool with this. And he actually pushes back with his questioning for a change. And, you know, Josh Matthews here was lucky to leave with his life the way that he was acting towards the Big Show. But Big Show was great here, telling a story with his facials. He was just great. Poor Daniel Bryan is going to be absolutely slaughtered. Main event saw CM Punk, Daniel Bryan, and Zack Ryder beat Miz, Alberto Del Rio, and Dolph Ziggler after Daniel Bryan tapped out Del Rio in the lapel lock. Del Rio hurt himself in this match. Nothing too serious, though. He shouldn't miss any TV time. The babyfaces came out through the crowd at the beginning of the match, giving them that sort of people's champion vibe. I thought that was pretty cool. I thought this was just a really fun, entertaining main event. Plain and simple. You know, the new world champion is made to look strong, making his opponent tap out. And the champions all stand tall to end the show. Can't ask for a better ending right there. You really can't. I don't know if they can sustain this goodwill with me. And in fact, the odds are against WWE handling all three men properly going forward. But you know what? If they can at least book one of the champions strongly, then that's fine. For WWE, that would actually be a pretty good batting average if they could do that. There was some bad on this show. How many times have I said in reviewing an Alicia Fox match that she either nearly killed or did kill someone with a kick? Pretty sure I've said that a whole bunch of times. Usually it's that axe kick, that Booker T axe kick that she kills people with. But on this show, she potatoed poor Beth Phoenix with a somersault leg drop and just came down right on top of her face. And then she pinned the women's champion clean, and that was it. It was a non-title match, of course. It looked absolutely brutal. And I think they also said during this match that Alicia Fox was trending on Twitter, which is enough of a reason not to take Twitter trending very seriously, quite frankly. Sheamus faced off with Jinder Mahal yet again this week. You may recall last week that Sheamus came out, kicked him in the face, and left. They didn't even have a match. Then I think they had an actual match on SmackDown, so here we go. I guess it was so good we had to see it again. At least this time they actually allowed the match to start instead of having Sheamus just kick him in the face and leave. This feud is doing more harm. You know, to me, it's doing more to harm Sheamus than to help Mahal. So I say please end this and just move Sheamus to somebody else. Anybody else. Anybody but Jinder Mahal. So then we had John Cena. And before I get to John Cena, I need a drink. Give me a second here. All right. That's what Cena promos have done to me, by the way. They've driven me to drink. That's how bad these things are. So Cena comes out 1 week after being chokeslammed by Kane and 24 hours after being left off the TLC pay-per-view. And I'll give you one guess as to what he did. Now, if you guessed that he came out and told jokes, ding ding, you win. More comedy bullshit. And, you know, it really hit me at this point with Cena being absent from the pay-per-view the night before. He was absent from the entire first hour of the show. Things felt a lot fresher without him in the picture. He really was not missed. Maybe by the kids, but fuck the kids. I don't care about the kids. I don't have any kids. I like this. I like the fact that John Cena wasn't around. And as soon as he started doing comedy, I realized why. It's not about him personally. It's about the way his character is booked to look like a complete fool. And to make things even worse, talk about being made to look like a fool. Instead of being angry that Kane targeted him and left him laying last week, he basically reacted like a chicken shit heel. And he said that if it was an accident, he would forgive Kane and let bygones be bygones. But if it was no accident, there would be trouble. What? Can you imagine Steve Austin, or The Rock, or The Undertaker, or even Randy frickin' Orton getting attacked 1 week and then coming out the next week and saying the same thing that John Cena said here? It is inconceivable to me you would have your top babyface react this way. Not saying he should come out and be snorting and spitting and cursing and all that. I know John Cena is a role model for kids, but this was just ridiculous. This was completely ridiculous. And if it was an accident, really. So I guess in his mind, maybe Kane had two masks on his face at the time, and he couldn't see that it was John Cena that he was chokeslamming. What kind of nonsense is this? Who booked this crap? Even if it was the wrong place, wrong time, which apparently it wasn't, since Kane attacked him again this week and is now ripping off various articles of clothing from his body, how do you not come out and tell Kane to get his ass to the ring for retribution? All the more reason why I enjoyed Kane's beatdown that followed. But I'm not sure that's the reaction WWE is going for with this. You know, is Cena going to go heel eventually or not? Probably not. But you know what? If he does go heel, it's still many months away. So I'm pretty sure that they were not hoping that people would be cheering for Kane to kill and murder and maim John Cena here, which is exactly the reaction they got from me. And I know that it was the reaction they got from a lot of you as well. So I just was completely perplexed by this booking here. I just could not believe that John Cena would come out and react that way. I should not be surprised by anything he is booked to say on television anymore. I really shouldn't. He said some pretty awful things, but this was just ridiculous. The ugly. There was really no ugly on this show, unless you count that leg drop from Alicia. The real ugliness came after the show, in the form of the Nielsen ratings. which were important for the show, you know, given the clear focus on younger and newer talent. I mean, in a lot of ways, and I think I've mentioned this before, you know, the ratings don't quite have the same significance that they did back in the day when there was a real wrestling war going on and you had two shows competing on the same night. Everybody, I mean, obviously the promoters, Eric Bischoff, lived and died by those numbers. Vince McMahon did as well to a lesser degree. WWE got its ass kicked for 83 straight weeks before finally winning a war in the ratings. But, you know, it meant more because there were two shows airing on the same night directly competing against one another, and both shows wanted to be number one. That's why it's called the Monday Night War. Well, the Monday Night War ended in 2001. Think about that. The Monday Night War ended a decade ago. Over a decade ago. We're heading into 2012 already. And so that's not to say the ratings are not important. Ratings are still very important. You know, ratings are important for TNA. I've talked about why. They put all the emphasis on Impact and practically none on their pay-per-views, but their logic is, well, we're at the mercy of Spike TV. You know, if our ratings were to suddenly take a nosedive and Spike decided, you know what, we don't want to be in bed with wrestling anymore, and they decided to cancel Impact, TNA as an organization ceases to exist. So I kind of get that. With WWE, they're pretty well locked into a contract with USA until 2014. You know, I've got this new network they're going to be launching. They're going to be okay. But the ratings are still very important. USA has an influence over the content of the show. And USA, it's very important to USA that they are number one in primetime cable rankings each week. Usually they're in pretty stiff competition with ESPN. But the ratings still, generally speaking, to wrestling fans, they don't mean as much as they used to. But as I said, on this show, it was very important because there was a clear focus on younger guys and newer guys. And Raw did a 2.9 rating this week, about 4.3 million viewers, which actually is kind of in line with what they've been doing. You know, now that they've dipped below a 3, I know it sounds completely awful. Oh my God, they did a 2.9, you know, Henny Penny, the sky is falling. But to be honest with you, Raw's pulled a 2.9 or a 3 rating quite often over the last several weeks. Part of that you might be able to blame on football. You can't blame football every week. There have been some pretty bad football games that people probably weren't really watching. They do have a built-in excuse here because the football game this week apparently did almost 17 million viewers. It was one of the, I think it was one of the highest rated football NFL games in cable television history. So obviously that took a chunk out of the show. You take the football game away, I think it's pretty safe to say the show probably does over a 3, either a 3 or a 3.1. But they did a 2.9, and that's fine. It's not even really the issue of you know, doing a 2.9. The issue here is the main event. The main event was CM Punk, Daniel Bryan, and Zack Ryder as your three top baby faces against three of your top heels in The Miz, Alberto Del Rio, and Dolph Ziggler. And the main event of Raw will typically gain anywhere from several 100,000 viewers, probably over 500,000 viewers, to as many as 1 million or more. You know, oftentimes when John Cena, is in the main event, his matches will gain 1 million viewers, maybe a little bit more than that. When The Rock has been on Raw, obviously they've gained close to 1.5 million viewers. Part of that is also the fact that, you know, when Raw goes off the air, Raw goes off the air at 11:05, 11:06, 11:07 sometimes. You have an audience there that's waiting for the next TV show to start. So you have some of those people already there. Raw's overrun always gains big-time viewers for one reason or another. And on this show, the main event of Raw gained less than 60,000 viewers. That's not good. That is not good. That is not good at all. And in fact, it may have been the lowest-rated Raw main event in over a decade. I haven't gone back to check to specifically see. It's possible, I suppose, there's been a main event somewhere in the last 10 or 12 years, maybe, that did just as bad, but nobody seems to have been able to find what that match is. This could very well be the lowest rated Raw main event going back to the Monday Night Wars, the early part of the Monday Night Wars. My fear, now, me personally, I don't care. I don't work for the company. I don't live and die by the ratings. I just talk about the ratings. I report the ratings. Sometimes the numbers are good. Sometimes the numbers are not good. I'm not a corporate suit in Titan Tower. So at the end of the day, I don't give a shit. But what I am concerned about is the fact that the people who work there care about the ratings. They care about the ratings quite a bit, probably more so than they should. And my concern here is that they're going to look at this, and little voices behind the scenes in WWE who probably don't like the fact that CM Punk is champion, and who don't like the fact that Daniel Bryan is champion, who probably don't even like Zack Ryder, are going to look at this and use this as ammunition to convince Vince McMahon and Stephanie McMahon and people like that why these guys should not be in the main event. Now, I'm not saying these guys should be in the main event every week. I don't want to see Zack Ryder in the main event every week. You know, Daniel Bryan is not going to be in the Raw main event every week. He's the SmackDown champion. CM Punk should be in the main event more often than not because he's your guy. He's the WWE champion. I don't want them to look at this and go, you know what, these guys are a failure. Clearly, nobody wants to watch these guys. Nobody cares about them. Let's take the title off Punk and put the title back on John Cena. Let's make John Cena and The Rock a championship match after all at WrestleMania. Daniel Bryan, wow, what a failure. The guy's been champion for 24 hours. I would hope that WWE has enough foresight to realize this and understand that they should probably keep the title on the guy for at least a couple more weeks. Give him a chance to sink and swim on his own. Let's see how the SmackDown ratings turn out, because to me, that's going to be the real test right there. If Daniel Bryan is really, truly ratings poison, the SmackDown numbers will drop, because the SmackDown numbers, for the most part, have been on the rise now ever since Mark Henry won the title. I don't know if you can just blame, or not blame, but give Mark Henry credit for that, but SmackDown has been doing really, really well on Sci-Fi over the last 3 or 4 months, and Mark Henry probably had a lot to do with that. They really made his character into something of a badass. He was kind of a different kind of world champion. And not a particularly great worker. So it's kind of the opposite now in that you have Daniel Bryan, who is a great wrestler. He can go in there and have great in-ring matches with almost anybody. But he's not a badass. You know? I like Daniel Bryan, but you're not going to convince me that when you stand Daniel Bryan, his character next to Mark Henry's character, that Daniel Bryan is a badass and Mark Henry is not. So Daniel Bryan is a different type of world champion than Mark Henry. Let's see how SmackDown does. If the SmackDown rating all of a sudden starts to take a nosedive, then there may be problems. But for now, I just hope people don't jump to conclusions. This show had a very fresh feel to it. I like that they tried something different. I want to see them try that more often. My biggest fear is that they're just going to go back to putting John Cena in the main event every week. But I can guarantee you that if they don't wait until the Royal Rumble to do John Cena versus Kane, you know, let's say on Raw this Monday night they announce that John Cena and Kane are going to have a match on January 2nd. They're already building that show up as something special with this mystery person. Perhaps they will set up a big main event for the show, and that main event will be Kane against John Cena. I can almost guarantee you that if that's the main event, Raw's main event is going to do very well. You'll see 500,000, 700,000 people tune in, maybe a million people tune into the main event. And you know, John Cena versus Kane is I guess, kind of a big-time match. I mean, in some ways, not really, but I just hope that this doesn't reflect poorly on the new guys they're trying to push, because this is what WWE needs to be doing more of. And 1 week does not really tell the story, you know? 2 weeks does not really tell the story. I want to see more of this. I want to see more of this on Raw, and I don't want this to have a negative impact on that. So that's your Raw review right there. Speaking of bad numbers, I don't want to spend too much more time on dreary numbers here, but I got to talk about this. The Survivor Series preliminary buy rate is in, and this buy rate will fluctuate. It will probably go up. Over the next couple of months, these numbers will change, but as of right now, it does not look like Survivor Series did very well at all. Survivor Series did better, I believe, than last year. But that's not really saying much at all. The pay-per-view was headlined by The Rock's first match back in over 7 years. And he teamed with his WrestleMania opponent John Cena to take on The Miz and R-Truth, two guys who I don't know that you could have booked them any more poorly than they did going into this pay-per-view. It wasn't about The Miz and R-Truth. It was just about seeing The Rock wrestle and seeing him team with John Cena, which, by the way, nobody wanted to see them team. You know, at first there was a little bit of excitement when it looked like they might be on opposite Survivor Series teams. I think that probably would have drawn better. But nobody wants to see Rock and John Cena as friends. Nobody wanted to see them shake hands on Raw that night after WrestleMania. The Rock got booed when he shook John Cena's hand. They want to see these guys beat the crap out of each other. More so, they want to see The Rock beat the crap out of John Cena. But this was your main event, and the pay-per-view did 280,000 buys worldwide, 160,000 buys domestically. 160,000 for The Rock's first match in over 7 years. You can't just blame The Rock for this. You know, he gets part of the blame, but this was just an all-around poor build-up to this match. Just awful, really, when you think about it. His first match back should have been a much bigger deal than it was. And, you know, to the people in the building that night, I was at Madison Square Garden. It was a big deal. Everybody loved seeing The Rock. I know there are people who say, oh, you talk about The Rock so much, you love The Rock. Hey, I'm telling it like it is. You know, I was in the building at Survivor Series, and at least in New York, the people went crazy for The Rock. And the people booed John Cena out of the building. That's just the way it's going to be at WrestleMania. That's the way, for the most part. John Cena has his fans. Some people hate The Rock, but for the most part, that's just how it is. So that night, people had a lot of fun. It was nice to see The Rock come back. But apparently, they could not convince people to buy the show because these numbers are not good. They're not good at all. Rock had a very big effect on WrestleMania business earlier in the year, but this was just apparently not what people wanted to see. So I guess, like I said, those numbers will shift over the next couple of months, but even if they go up a little bit, they're not going to go up that much. This was just a bad number, plain and simple. There is a big celebrity match and discussion for WrestleMania coming up in Miami. Shaquille O'Neal was on a show on Sirius Satellite Radio this week, I believe the Abe Kanin show, and he kind of spilled the beans, which could not have made WWE very happy, that he was in discussions with the company to potentially take on The Big Show at WrestleMania 28. Now, this was a match that they had teased doing back in 2009. Shaquille O'Neal was one of the early guest hosts for Raw. In fact, he may have been the second or third celebrity guest host when they were doing the first start of the concept. And Shaq did a pretty good job. I think Shaq was like really the first good guest host they had. And Shaq has been a wrestling fan for most of his life. He's done stuff with WCW and WWE before. You know, he knows what to do when he's out there, when he's on camera. They did a confrontation with him in The Big Show. They teased that they might have a match at SummerSlam. The match never happened. He was never going to be cleared. At the time, he was still, you know, an NBA player. Now Shaq is retired. He is no longer playing basketball. He is no longer bound by contracts. He is no longer bound by any team. He can do whatever he wants. And it looks as though this is not set in stone, but it looks like this match may actually happen. You know, Big Show was in one celebrity match with Floyd Mayweather a couple of years ago, got knocked out by a pair of brass knucks. I don't see Shaq agreeing to do a match in WWE and taking a knockout punch from the Big Show and getting pinned. So, you know, it may be another situation where Big Show gets beaten and embarrassed by a celebrity non-wrestler. But you know what? I'm sure Big Show makes some pretty good coin when he agrees to do things like this. I don't know. You know, Big Show and Shaq, I like it. I like the idea. It's just another attraction for WrestleMania, another way for them to get some mainstream publicity for the show. And really, what else are they going to do with Big Show? Big Show should not be competing for a championship. Big Show is really doesn't have any other big match that he could have. I mean, who else would you put Big Show in the ring with? Mark Henry? You want to keep that feud going? I don't think so. There really is no other match. Big Show and Kane? I don't need to see that match again. So if they want to do Big Show and Shaquille O'Neal, it's a fun thing to do. It doesn't take away from any of the other matches in the show. I say why not? I say go for it. Hopefully they can work something out. There were some reports that came out this week about Chris Hero. Chris Hero, of course, a big star in the independent circuit and known for his Kings of Wrestling tag team with Claudio Castagnoli. Claudio did sign with WWE. They were supposed to come in together. They were not necessarily going to be brought up to the main roster together, but they were going to sign with WWE at the same time. And Claudio, who had one time been recruited by WWE and then something happened, I think it was some sort of visa issue, and WWE passed on him. And that was a couple of years ago. So here he gets a second opportunity. He takes his physical exams and all that, and he passes. He's now down in Florida Championship Wrestling with his new name, Antonio Cesaro. And Chris Hero has kind of been in limbo now these last couple of months. A lot of people asking questions. What's going on with Chris Hero? Is he coming in? Is there some sort of problem? Did he fail a test? What's going on here? And there was a report that came out earlier in the week that got picked up by a few wrestling websites. Not exactly the most reputable wrestling websites, but, you know, there's been so many questions and just a big mystery around this whole Chris Hero issue. It would almost make sense to believe that something happened here. The initial reports indicated that Hiro had failed a drug test administered by WWE for elevated testosterone levels. When you have elevated testosterone levels, that's not normal. Typically, that is not normal. That's usually the indicator that there is some foreign substance that you have put in your body, either knowingly or unknowingly. And let's be honest, usually it's knowingly, no matter what the person claims. It appears that those reports may not, in fact, be accurate. Chris Hero did tweet something this week. He did not tweet anything to deny the reports, which was kind of interesting. His tweet was, quote, "I don't think I will ever be done with wrestling. Thank you for your continued support." In some ways, that tweet was a little bit cryptic because he didn't deny the reports, and he was being a little vague. But what it does appear to be, it does not appear as though he failed any tests. Hiro is still likely on his way into WWE. There is some sort of medical testing issue. I don't know that it's a test failure. I guess it could be. But it looks like he has some sort of medical issue that's being addressed. And WWE would expect to it to be cleared up, and they could sign him as early as January. So the hope is that come next month, Chris Hero will officially be part of the WWE roster down in developmental. He had some medical testing done in September, was the last time he was tested. So I guess the hope is that in January, when they retest him, everything will come back clean. And let's hope it does. Chris Hero is he's a good talent. He deserves, I think, a shot. I think Chris Hero could be a big star in WWE. He's not a big jacked-up dude, but he's tall. He's a tall guy. And he's very charismatic. He's got a good character. He's good on the microphone. He can be a really good heel addition, I think, to their roster. As much as I would love to see Hero and Claudio still together as a tag team wrestling is just, it's not a priority in WWE. So, quite frankly, these two guys deserve better. They don't deserve to be put together in a tag team that's just going to flounder and do nothing. So, you know, each guy has had some success on the independent circuit as a single star. I have no doubt they could both be big stars, single stars in WWE as well. So, hopefully the issue with Hiro gets cleared up and he'll be signed next month. Another interesting story here. This is credit to a report from PW Insider earlier in the week. WWE apparently very quietly held a television taping in Florida several weeks ago at a university. It was a television taping that involved mostly developmental talent from FCW. There were some WWE stars from the main roster there as well. They were filming some I guess, different pilot programs to potentially use for the new WWE network. Of course, they are going to need a lot of new programming to fill time on this network. And this was one idea that they had. One idea was having a one-hour television show pretty much devoted to the developmental program and FCW. And the other idea they had was for a shorter half-an-hour show that would focus on either a match or a rivalry. I guess kind of similar to the countdown shows that UFC does, although I think those are an hour. But, you know, one match that was taped at this television taping was Antonio Cesaro against Seth Rollins. So you had here Claudio Castagnoli against the former Tyler Black from Ring of Honor. That was pretty cool. They had other guys on the taping. Sheamus was there. Daniel Bryan was there. Cody Rhodes. I think Drew McIntyre. Jim Ross handled the announcing duties for part of the taping, not the entire thing, but he was there. Triple H and John Laurinaitis. John Laurinaitis was there. They were both at the taping. And, you know, apparently this is never going to see the light of day, this footage. This was just specifically for pilot purposes. They were just testing some ideas out. But yeah, to me, it's kind of a cool thing. You know, I think they're going to need a lot of programming for the new network. I've always said that, you know, they own, as far as I know, they own the old OVW footage from Ohio Valley Wrestling from the early days of their own developmental system. I don't know why they never decided to put that on WWE Classics On Demand. I know it's called WWE Classics, but they've had a lot of different types of programming, original content. I always thought there was a space on their on-demand service to put some of those old OVW shows, and they never did. And I don't know that they'll show OVW shows on the new network, but any way they can utilize the developmental system, and if they want to have a show kind of devoted to it to bring people into the fold, to show them what goes on down in Florida. I know they don't like showing these guys before they have a chance to come to the main roster and be a big star. You know, that's part of Triple H's new doctrine with developmental. He doesn't want to bring guys up to TV until they're ready, until they have an idea to push them. They don't want to bring guys up to TV, have them flounder, and then, you know, it kind of kills their career, and then they send them back down. But I like this idea. I like this idea a lot. I find it quite odd, though, that they would have a TV taping like this. And I mean, granted, it was at a university. There probably weren't that many people there. But aside from this one lone report on PW Insider's site that somebody sent in, it wasn't as though you had people who attended the taping sending in reports. This was quite the covert operation on their part. I don't know if they had people sign non-disclosure agreements or confidentiality agreements or what. But I just thought that was kind of interesting. Speaking of interesting things, there is a potential physical WWE Hall of Fame now finally in the works. This has been an idea that's been talked about now for a number of years. And again, I said earlier, the Hall of Fame, really, for all intents and purposes, it is a figment of Vince McMahon's imagination. It does not exist but in his mind and on DVD. But there is no physical building that people can go visit to see, you know, who's in the Hall of Fame, almost like a museum-type thing. Like, they have the Baseball Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Hockey Hall of Fame. So apparently there's been a lot more talks in recent weeks about there being a physical place to house the WWE Hall of Fame. They've been looking at places in Florida, as well as other places like New York, as a potential area for it. This also ties into the new network. They would like to have something, you know, if they had a physical Hall of Fame, they could promote it practically every day if they wanted to on their new television network. They could film stuff from the Hall of Fame as well. They can have, I mean, I've said, that was one of the ideas I've had before. You know, you can have promotional events, and when they have those press conferences, like in New York, before WrestleMania and stuff like that, you know, you can have press conferences from the Hall of Fame. You can put a store in there and sell merchandise. You can have autograph signings there every week if you want to send, you know, some wrestlers over there to sign autographs and take pictures and charge them $10 a pop or whatever. I mean, there's so many things you can do if you have a physical place. They used to have WWF New York in Times Square, their restaurant, which flopped. The Hall of Fame, you know, I don't know what kind of business you're going to be able to do. It might not be a success. It depends. I mean, they can't put their Hall of Fame in Times Square. I mean, rent in Times Square is astronomical. That's one of the reasons why WWF New York failed. Maybe it makes more sense to do something in Florida, quite frankly. Maybe it won't be as expensive for them to house a Hall of Fame. But I just thought it was interesting that this may actually happen. It's being very seriously discussed. They've been collecting a lot of wrestling artifacts and memorabilia from different performers to potentially be put up on display in a Hall of Fame in the future. So I think that would be very cool. I would very much like to visit a WWE Hall of Fame, whether it was in New York or not. I think if it was in Florida, it's the perfect opportunity, quite frankly, to take a vacation. You know, Florida is a vacation destination, Orlando in particular, but Florida in general is a pretty popular vacation destination. I think it would be very smart on their part, quite frankly, to do it in Florida and not New York, even though I'd love to see it in New York. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. Another note here. On a departing WWE talent, ring announcer Eden Styles, her real name is Brandi Reed, she was let go. Actually, she requested her release, I should say, and they granted it. She was doing the ring announcing on WWE Superstars, apparently, for quite some time. I wouldn't know because I don't watch Superstars. But she is gone. She says that she requested her release 3 weeks ago. Leaves the company on good terms. And like I said, I'll be honest, I don't watch Superstars, so I had no idea who this woman was. But I saw pictures of her, and she is absolutely stunning. And on Twitter, she revealed that she is, in fact, for those of you interested, dating Cody Rhodes. To which I say, it must be good to be Cody Rhodes these days. I mean, he finally dumped that awful gimmick with the mask and the baggers, which went on for far too long. He's the Intercontinental Champion. He's got the new, I guess the new old title, if you want to call it that, around his waist. Much better looking belt, by the way. He's becoming more of a focal point on the shows, and on top of all that, he goes from dating Layla to this. Well played, sir. I give you a sound-off salute. I'm giving Cody Rhodes the first sound-off salute. I may make this a new weekly gimmick. And if I do, Cody Rhodes, you get the first sound-off salute, my friend. Before we get to the mailbag, I did a movie review last week on 197 for a movie called WrestleManiac. I try to limit my movie reviews now to wrestling-specific movies so people won't bitch as much. And that movie featured Rey Mysterio Sr. as a killer luchador. Like I said, you can't go wrong. The movie was absolutely dreadful, but it's entertaining enough. So, somebody posted on my Facebook wall, I think it was Jason, it may have been the one who posted a link to a scene from a movie called Santa's Sleigh. Now, I knew this movie existed. It's not like I'd never heard of it before. But for whatever reason, I think I just assumed it was a kid's movie. It stars Bill Goldberg as Santa Claus, and I just assumed, why would I want to watch this movie? And he posted a scene from it, and it caught my interest. Because this is, in fact, not a kid's movie. In fact, it is pretty fucking far from being a family movie at all. And a quick synopsis here from IMDb says that Bill Goldberg plays the devil's son, or one of the devil's sons, who lost a wager with an angel and was forced to spend 1,000 years playing Santa. But that wager has expired now, and good old Saint Nick is not so joyful anymore. He makes up for lost time and begins to kill people. So, much like last week when I read that this WrestleManiac movie was about a killer luchador who goes around maiming people and ripping their faces off, I said, how could I not watch a Christmas movie starring Bill Goldberg, the biggest Jew I know, as Santa Claus who goes around murdering people? That sounds like either the worst movie ever or the absolute best movie of all time. So, I decided to watch the movie, thanks on Jason's recommendation. And this is quite the film. This is quite the holiday film. I would say that if you are a fan of horror movies, if you have a good, sick, demented, twisted sense of humor as I do, you will enjoy this movie. If you are, in fact, somebody who takes Christmas very seriously, if you are a religious person, if you don't like movies where people are murdered and maimed, I would stay away from this film. But if you like films like this, I would recommend it. Again, it is not a great movie in terms of being, you know, it's not going to win any awards. Maybe it'll win a Razzie or something. But in some ways, it's actually quite a phenomenal film. And what I didn't realize is, you know, again, it stars Bill Goldberg. So, you know, there's your wrestling tie-in right there. One of the most popular WCW champions of all time, former world heavyweight champion in WWE, the man who ended Bret Hart's career. He's in the movie, but also there's another wrestler in this movie. Zeus is in the movie. Debo, as a gas station cashier, he is in this movie. He says he moved to this small town because there was too much violence in the hood. I thought that was a great line. One of my favorite scenes, actually, in the entire movie, kind of, nothing major. It actually comes very early on in the film. There's a really mean old lady who is ordering food from a deli, I think, and she's just a real bitch. I mean, just a real bitch. And she gets in her car, and she's driving home, and she's swerving all over the place because, you see, she's short, and she's old. So she's swerving left and right all over the road, and Bill Goldberg is in his sleigh right behind her trying to get by. And she is just swerving to the left, and he tries to go around, and she swerves to the right. And Goldberg just yells out, "Oh, it's down!" I just lost my shit. I just thought it was great. And it reminded me of the song, by the way, of the same name. So anyway, Goldberg ends up running her off the road. She dies, and all is right with the world. There's another scene in the movie where Nicholas, who is the young kid, he's one of the main characters in the movie, if not the main character. Him and his little girlfriend there, Mary, I think her name is, are being chased by the evil Santa Goldberg. And I don't know how they ended up here. They're on an ice skating rink. And Goldberg commandeers a Zamboni, yet again, doing his best Steve Austin imitation. And he's coming after the kids, and Nicholas shines a light, like a flashlight, in Goldberg's face. And Goldberg just stops and just yells at him and says,
"I'm Santa Claus, not fucking Dracula!"
Again, another great line in this movie. This movie has some great lines, I have to say. The kid's grandfather in this movie he's really, basically, I'm giving this away, but the kid's grandfather is really an angel who had made a bet with him. He's the angel that made a bet with Santa Goldberg 1,000 years earlier. Of course, the kid's grandfather would be the same angel. And the movie ends, you know, kind of on a happy note. Goldberg's character doesn't die. He actually is in the last scene of the film. I guess they're going for comedy at the end. I thought it was kind of a stupid ending. Just like WrestleManiac last week, I thought also had a stupid ending. But anyway, it's just a fun, stupid film that has a couple of really great lines. There's really some actually laugh-out-loud moments in this movie. And it's got Bill Goldberg with, as Santa Claus killing people. I mean, come on. What is there not to like about that? The opening scene of the movie has Bill Goldberg and Fran Drescher, two of the biggest Jews around, in a Christmas movie. Clearly, they were trying to go over the top with this movie. And I hate Fran Drescher, by the way. I just think she's one of the most annoying people on the face of the earth. Quick story here. I did a PR event a couple of years ago. It was actually a charity celebrity poker tournament. And I was asked to help out that night by being in the pit. And I know nothing about poker. I don't gamble. I don't play poker. I don't know. I play video poker. That's about it. So they said, all you got to do is just stand there in the middle. All these different tables are going to be around you. All these people are going to be playing games. And anybody who wants to rebuy will raise their hand. They'll wave their credit card in your face. And you just come over and you fill out a sheet. That's all I had to do. And even that, I still didn't know exactly what the hell I was doing. So, you know, there were people there that night. Quincy Jones was there. And Brad Garrett from Everybody Loves Raymond, who is a tall son of a bitch, let me tell you. He was there. Montel Williams was blitzed out of his mind playing poker. Wanted a rebuy, flashed a Black American Express card in my face. I tried to convince him maybe he shouldn't do this, and he said, no, I got a $2,000 rebuy here. So then I hear this laugh, and I said, God damn, like, where is that coming from? And sure enough, I turn around, and there's Fran Drescher. And I could just tell by that god-awful laugh of hers. And she was standing right behind me laughing. She was there with two guys, no surprise. And I just was, my ears just felt like they were bleeding. I just could not stand. This woman was laughing the entire time, and I just was, you know, we're in the Rainbow Room in Rockefeller Center, 65 floors up, and I just said, I'm going to jump through this window and just end it. I mean, this is just, her laugh is just so unbelievably annoying. It was just ridiculous. So you can imagine my great joy watching her, you know, get drowned in a bowl of eggnog in this movie. I mean, come on. It's worth an hour and 15 minutes of your time just for that first opening scene alone. In fact, if you don't want to watch the whole movie, you don't have to. You can find that opening scene on YouTube. There was a link to it on my Facebook page. And just go check it out, and that'll give you a sense of what kind of movie this is. James Caan is in the opening scene as well. There was another actress, I forget her name. There's some names in this movie. So again, if you're in the mood for some holiday fun and you're tired of all these cliched, cheesy, campy, bullshit Christmas movies, you know, and even those of you who are listening to this show now and Christmas, I'm sure, is now over, find Santa's Sleigh and watch it, and then you can thank me later on. Actually, don't thank me. Thank Jason. He's the one who... He's the one who actually brought the movie to my attention. So this was actually, in many ways, very fun and still a terrible movie, but fun nonetheless. So there you go. That's my Christmas show review for Santa's Sleigh, starring Bill Goldberg as a killer Santa Claus. And now, Santa Solomon. So I'm going to put my hat on here. You can't see this, but I'm actually going to put my Kris Kringle hat on. It's time for the Santa Solomon mailbag here on the Christmas show. Ah, yes, sleigh bells are ringing. You know, Santa Claus actually sent a question in for the mailbag to me, but that fat bastard never gets me any gifts, so screw him. I'm not answering his question, but I will answer yours. You can email me questions, as always, to thesolomonster@gmail.com. This one comes from Jay from Florida, who is a member of the Triple Threat. Why he's not a member of the Fantastic Four, I don't know, but... He was recently watching a match on YouTube involving Seth Rollins and Hunico, which is a pretty good match. At about 12 minutes or so in, I could not believe my ears. The announcer actually said, FCW Universe. I had to laugh and roll my eyes simultaneously. Did you know that there was more than one universe? Shouldn't it be called the FCW Galaxy or something? What are your thoughts? Well, you see, in WWE solar system, you can have multiple universes. You can have multiple galaxies. You know, just like WWE's laws, you know, they operate under a different set of laws than the rest of us. You can attempt to murder somebody. You could attempt to kill somebody and maim them with a sledgehammer. You could try to run them down with a car and not go to jail. Or if you do go to jail, they release you a few hours later on your own recognizance. So they operate under a different set of rules and laws than you and I do. So, of course, under the WWE logic, you can have more than one universe. Stewart writes in, do you think that Jim Ross would be as mistreated as he is if Stone Cold Steve Austin was still one of the top stars in the company? I do. I don't really see that one has to do with the other. Austin has said that he would only wrestle another match if Jim Ross called it, so he could still pull a power play if he wants to. But when Jim Ross had to kiss Vince McMahon's ass, you know, Steve Austin was still working for the company at the time. It's not like he was able to stop that from happening. You know, Jim Ross is a company guy. He'll do what he's told to do. He gets paid very well. He gets to promote his barbecue products. I don't like it, but it doesn't matter what I think. You know, Jim Ross does what he's told to do, whether Austin was there or not. I don't think Vince McMahon would stop poking fun at Jim Ross. He gets too much pleasure out of it. Kenneth writes in, a coworker told me a story that The Undertaker, Paul Bearer, Savio Vega, and Yokozuna, along with a few others, formed their own type of clique in the mid-90s. In a way, it was to try to counter the actual clique. For what? I don't know. Maybe political power. Did you ever hear about this? No. I never heard of another, you know, clique. I know that guys like Undertaker and Savio and Yokozuna were actually all friends. They all did hang in the same circles. I don't know that they ever formed a clique to counter the actual clique. It wasn't like there was some sort of backstage, you know, faction warfare going on. I don't think that part of the story is true. But yes, Undertaker and Savio and Yoko and I think Henry Godwin and a bunch of guys like that, they were all very good friends. They all hung out together and drank together and all that back in the day. That is true. Joey from Louisville writes in with two questions. First of all, what are your thoughts on Kerry Von Erich's ring work? When I first started watching wrestling as a kid, he was already in the WWF doing the Texas Tornado gimmick. I remember really liking the character as a kid, but don't really remember any standout matches that he had. It was only later on that I discovered his as well as his brother's grisly fate. I now know that him and his family were huge in World Class Championship Wrestling. Did Kerry have any 4 or 5-star matches before he got to the WWF? If I wanted to see some of his earlier work, where would you recommend that I start? Honestly, the easiest place for you to start is YouTube. There's a ton of USWA matches, WCCW matches, old matches like that that you can find on YouTube. WWE did release the World Class DVD, which was kind of a documentary on the company. I'm pretty sure there were some Kerry matches on there, certainly in the documentary, if not in the extras. As far as any 4 or 5-star matches he had, I mean, I didn't grow up on World Class Championship Wrestling, so my exposure to it is probably about as limited as yours is. I know it through, you know, matches I've seen online, through the documentaries, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. But Kerry had, you know, a great match, at least one great match with Ric Flair. Again, it's Ric Flair. Ric Flair would have great matches with almost anybody back in the day. But him and Flair, you know, in particular, had a great match at their Parade of Champions show, I believe, back in 84. He had more matches with Flair, including, I think there was at least one match that they had that was on a Coliseum video in WWF in 91. But by that point, I mean, not that Kerry was ever a great, great, great worker, but, you know, by that point, he was nothing what he used to be in the early 80s. You know, again, Kerry was in a motorcycle accident in the late 80s and had to have his foot amputated, and he was never really the same after that. Plus, you know, especially in his WWF run, I don't know if I'm the only one who ever noticed this, but Kerry Von Erich always looked stoned out of his mind. I mean, he very rarely looked like he was all there. I don't know if it was drugs, I don't know if it's just his personality, I don't know what the hell it was, but beyond that, I'm not such a big fan of Kerry Von Erich's work that I know of every great match he ever had. I think he had some great matches with Jerry Lawler as well in the mid-80s, but I'm not coming up with too many in the way of 4 and 5-star matches that he ever had. And as far as the second question here that Joey has, as a kid, not only did I like the WWF, but I also loved USWA. I'm originally from Indiana, and I remember going across the bridge to the Louisville Gardens for live shows and watching the TV show. For the longest time, I thought Ric Flair stole his theme music from them. In our part of the country, USWA was probably just as big as WWF. I remember that there was a wrestler named The Gravedigger, which was basically an Undertaker ripoff. He wasn't around too long, but he scared the crap out of me as a kid, possibly due to how cheap and low rent he was. Do you have any idea who this guy was and if he ever went on to the big leagues? I tell you what, I looked into this, and I was not able to come up with who The Gravedigger was. I don't believe he went on to anything in the big leagues, but I don't know, because I don't know who he is. I don't know who played him. If he was a journeyman wrestler, if he was somebody who did go on maybe to WCW or something like that, I came up empty-handed. So if there's anybody out there who knows anything about the identity of the Gravedigger, you can let me know. It's funny you mentioned the Gravedigger being an Undertaker ripoff. You know, somebody, again, I think it might have been on my Facebook page, posted a link to this, but there was a character briefly in the USWA when Jerry Lawler was champion. This would have been around 1992 or so, called The Christmas Creature. This big 7-foot-tall guy dressed in green and red, and you know, he had like garland all over him. He looked completely ridiculous. He looked like a giant candy cane. And he was supposed to be taken seriously as a killer, I guess. I think he was managed by Burt Prentice. Anyway, Christmas Creature was, in fact, Glenn Jacobs, who would go on to become Kane many years later. And there was a segment on SmackDown back in 2001. It was Ric Flair's Christmas Party, when Ric Flair was... this is about a month after Flair came back. He was the co-owner of the WWF. And it was one of these these comedy backstage segments over the holidays when everyone's having a party and drinking and they do comedy and all that. And Kane was back then still wearing his full mask, and they did some comedy where I think Prince Albert and somebody else, I forgot who, were trying to convince Kane to become more festive, and they were putting ornaments on him, and they put a Santa hat on him, and they tried to get him to drink, and Kane refused to drink. You hear Jerry Lawler on commentary, just a very quick soundbite, saying that, hey, you know, Kane looks like some sort of Christmas creature. And I never got the significance of that until I saw this video the other day. So another little interesting factoid, you know, back in the day, the USWA would have... These were not the only kind of cheap, low-rent gimmicks or rip-off gimmicks or just completely ridiculous gimmicks that they would have. In fact, many times they would bring in guys with these ridiculous gimmicks just so that they could give Jerry Lawler somebody to feud with and beat up, because Lawler was the man. And Lawler won, quite literally, I think, just dozens and dozens and dozens of championships, and he was on top of the territory for many years. So that might have actually been Kane's debut as a wrestler in this country, anyway. Might have been as the Christmas Creature in the USWA. Quite an auspicious debut for somebody who would go on to become a world heavyweight champion. Next question here comes from Chris Baker from Wymondham, England, who writes in. I believe this is his first question getting on the sound off here. He was thinking about the Money in the Bank briefcase after seeing TLC and Daniel Bryan's win. In every previous match that involved the Money in the Bank briefcase, when the holder has cashed it in, both challenger and champion had to be standing before the referee would ring the bell to start the match. In the case of Daniel Bryan's two cash-ins that he had, well, the one failed cash-in and then the one where he actually won, he came to the ring, gave the briefcase to the ref rang the bell, and then he just pinned the champion, who was on the mat, 1-2-3. So in this way, after thinking about it, although other people have cashed in on a downed opponent, they still had to hit that one move to get the win, and all Daniel Bryan had to do was lay on the big show. Although this may be thinking about something a little bit too much, do you think WWE's way of keeping the Money in the Bank briefcase winner winning the championship... As Daniel Bryan did, they wanted the winner to win. But, at the same time, was this their way to make Daniel Bryan look weaker? Although he has had great matches over the last couple of months, his wins are very few and far between. Which, again, begs the question, Chris makes a very good point, why would you book Daniel Bryan to lose almost every single match that he has had since Money in the Bank? I know his losing streak ended recently, but still. He lost for like 4 straight months. He looked completely inept. He looked like a jabroni. And then you're going to put the championship on him. I mean, I know they sometimes have a habit of beating somebody before they actually end up winning, whether it's the Royal Rumble. You know, there's some people saying that Randy Orton, the reason he's lost so much lately is because he's going to win the Royal Rumble in St. Louis next month, which he might. You know, we may still yet get a Randy Orton-Daniel Bryan championship match, which is a match that I was kind of hoping for. You know, before I started talking about Randy Orton and The Undertaker as a potential match, I said that I'd love to see Randy Orton and Daniel Bryan for the championship. Of course, I didn't know they were going to actually take the title off Mark Henry, which I thought was dumb, but then I found out Mark Henry was hurt. So, I mean, what are you going to do? But anyway, you know, the point that Chris is trying to make here is an interesting one, but you're thinking too much about this. You're trying to apply logic to something that, again, defies logic. WWE will change the rules as it goes along. They've changed the rule. They've done this for years. And yes, at one point, somebody had to be on their knees, at least, or had to be on their feet before the referee would ring the bell. If they made a big deal about it on Raw the next night, you know, by claiming that perhaps it wasn't an official victory because Big Show was not up and it was going to play into a storyline, that's one thing. But obviously, I don't think they've said word one about it. Either they forgot, or they just decided to change the rules. So I just think you're overthinking this a little bit too much. Does it make Daniel Bryan look weak? It does. It does make him look a little bit weak. But you know what? The championship is on him now. The ball's in his court. He can change all... I mean, I guess it's not up to him. He has to be booked properly. But he can go out there and start winning matches and making people tap out like he did with Del Rio on Raw and try to gain back some of that credibility that he once had. You know, when he won Money in the Bank in July, it was a really cool moment, and I thought they were going to be actually building him up as a challenger for the championship. But when he started losing every single week, it's kind of like Rey Mysterio winning the championship the first time. You know, Rey Mysterio won the title at WrestleMania 22 and had one of the most awful title reigns as a world champion in WWE history. He just got beat in non-title matches every single week, it seemed like. He got beat by the Great Khali, clean, 1-2-3. I mean, he was the weakest world champion to come along in many, many years, maybe ever, that they had booked. And I fear they may do the same thing with Daniel Bryan. I'm encouraged by the outcome of Raw Monday night. But again, they may look at those Raw ratings and say, you know what, this guy can't cut it. We got to get the title off him as soon as possible. I hope that does not happen. Derek from Missouri writes in. He is now a Fantastic Four member, so congratulations to Derek. Basically, his question is, he wants to know if WWE would ever release an Undertaker DVD focused on the undefeated streak, where they had all of his WrestleMania matches on a single DVD, perhaps with some additional commentary from The Undertaker himself, commenting about each match. I think that would be a hell of an idea. And again, it's one of those things I could easily see them doing. It's why Undertaker's streak is not ending. You know, people who think, oh my God, it's going to be Undertaker and Triple H again at WrestleMania. There's no way Triple H will lose three times at WrestleMania to The Undertaker. Well, yeah, you know what? Undertaker is a different kind of beast. Undertaker is that one guy, other than Triple H, left on the roster. He's been there longer than Triple H. He is the most well-respected guy backstage as far as the current active or semi-active talents. If there's one guy Triple H I would think does not mind putting over or knows that he has to put over, it's The Undertaker. I don't know that Triple H would extend that same sort of courtesy to anybody else or The Rock, you know, or anybody like that. But to Undertaker, it's a different story. I'm sure that Triple H has the utmost of respect for The Undertaker and realizes that for him to break the streak would be a huge mistake. And if for no other reason, for marketing opportunities like this. You know, Undertaker loses, and yeah, you could still do an Undertaker DVD where he talks about the 19 matches he did win, but it kind of ruins the whole thing, you know? By keeping the streak alive, I don't know if this will be Undertaker's last WrestleMania match, whether he wins or not. I mean, he can try to go 25-0 if he wants to, but if this is it, there's a tremendous marketing opportunity there to put together a DVD set chronicling the Undertaker's 20-0 streak with exclusive comments from him, and you throw in some extra clips in the build-up to some of the matches. That could be a DVD set, a three-disc set all by itself. So I think that's a very good idea. And in fact, I would be surprised if WWE didn't do it. Scott writes in, is it just me or does the new WWE Network commercial music sound a lot like the new song Narcissistic Cannibal? I believe Narcissistic Cannibal is a Korn song, and Skrillex did, a remixed version of it, or maybe that is the song and Skrillex did it. I don't know. I don't know all the details. I'm familiar with the song, but not too much. But Skrillex was involved. Skrillex is the guy who also did the remix of that Benny Benassi song, which is what you hear in the WWE Network commercials. And it's actually a song called Cinema, and Skrillex did a remix of it, which is, I love that song a lot. I'm a fan of his work. I know some people are not. I was actually quite surprised when I looked up a picture of what this Skrillex fella looked like. Not exactly what I was expecting to see, but hey, you know, sometimes that's how it works. You don't judge a book by its cover. Either way, I am actually a fan of his remixes. Believe it or not, he actually did a remix, and I know not everybody is a fan of Lady Gaga, but for whatever it's worth, he actually did some remixes of some of her songs that sound even better than the original songs themselves, so you might want to check that out. Jake from Long Island, New York, I just realized that when Big Show won the world title at TLC, he has now held the WWE, ECW, World Heavyweight, and WCW titles. Do you know of anyone else who has won all of these championships in their career? I do not. I believe Big Show may be the only person who can actually lay claim to having won both of WWE's world titles, the WWE version of the ECW title, and the actual WCW championship. I think he probably is the only person to do that. And if he isn't, then find me who else is. Maybe there's one other person, but I'm pretty sure Big Show is the only one. So another accomplishment under the Big Show's belt for his eventual induction into the Hall of Fame. I'll tell you what, by the way, when he did that promo on Raw, Big Show, and made reference to the fact that it had been 9 years since he had held a world championship, and obviously he ignored the ECW title reign, as most people do. I mean, for example, most people do not acknowledge that Matt Hardy was a world champion, because he wasn't. The ECW title was treated like crap. The brand didn't last very long. To me, it doesn't count. And Big Show apparently didn't count it either, or at least whoever wrote his promo didn't. And he made reference 9 years since he held the world championship. I could not believe that it had been that long. But in fact, it goes back to the match where he beat Brock Lesnar at Survivor Series in 2002. That was the last world championship that Big Show won. I couldn't believe it. But it's true. So, yeah, been a long time. Lance from Florence, South Carolina writes in. He is a sound-off addict since episode 101. Has not missed a show. He says, I've been following your Chris Jericho returning segments the last couple of weeks, and you seem so convinced that he's coming back. My question is, why are you so convinced that the January 2nd vignettes are signaling his imminent return to the ring? Granted, I believe WWE is desperately trying to lure him back, but I don't see it happening, and I would have to disagree with you. What symbolism of these vignettes indicates to you that it is referring to Y2J? From the language and the dark message it promotes, I immediately think of The Undertaker. However, I just saw the article on Skip Sheffield hinting at an angle. Could be him. Anyways, Jericho recently threw out the fact that he would be busy recording during the road to WrestleMania to further shoot down these rumors. Y2J has repeatedly denied this, and the way that he's been talking, I would think he's done with wrestling. I guess time will tell, and I would be highly surprised if he ever comes back again. Well, first of all, the fact that Jericho would deny it right there, for you to take him for gospel when he says that, oh, you know, I'm going to be busy, you know, I'm going to be recording a new album from January to March, so obviously it can't be me, for you to believe him is quite a naive thing for you to do. Is it true? Is it possible that he could be recording new music? Sure, anything's possible. But the fact that he would go on Twitter and mention these things to further muddy the waters and indicate to people that, hey, look, I'm going to be busy doing other things, is a telltale sign that he's trying to throw people off track. Okay? That's what that's all about. Jericho is going to wrestle again. He's going to wrestle again in 2012. Anybody who thinks differently is just fooling themselves. He is not done with wrestling. As far as the vignettes for January 2nd, I mean, look, is it going to be Chris Jericho? I don't know for 100% certainty. I'm not even sure if WWE knows. You know, there's been rumors that, yes, they're trying to get Jericho back. Maybe they don't have a deal. And if not, then they have a backup plan to use the vignettes to signal The Undertaker's return. Triple H has already mentioned The Undertaker on television. Perhaps they're going to get their angle started early. To me, it doesn't make sense, because what are you going to bring The Undertaker back for at the beginning of January? You know, maybe the Royal Rumble. Probably after the Royal Rumble. But even the Rumble, okay, I could see that. But you bring The Undertaker back January 2nd, what's he going to do? He's going to start wrestling matches on TV leading up to WrestleMania? I would hardly think so. Seems a little bit too early for The Undertaker to make his actual television return at the beginning of January for a WrestleMania match in April. Could it be Skip Sheffield? Sure. You know, there's been a lot of talk about this Ryback character. I've been waiting. I have been anticipating the return of Skip Sheffield. I really think there's something there with this guy. He could be a big star, probably either as a heel or a face, especially a baby face. I think there's a lot of potential there. But could it be him? Sure. He's ready to come back. He started wrestling on the house shows again, and he's hinted that sometime in 2012 he will make his comeback. Could it be him? It's possible. You know, the thing with Jericho is, if you look at the most recent vignette, and there's been some screen caps taken from the latest video, you see the name Chris crossed out on a notepad that was brushed onto the floor by the little girl, I believe. So, and I've seen shots of it. It clearly says Chris with an X over it. And I've seen people come up with theories about how this is some sort of a metaphor signaling the return of Chris Jericho, who is he's feeling shunned by the new talent that is CM Punk, and this will lead into their feud. Who knows? You know, it's kind of like some of these movies when they have these viral marketing campaigns, and everybody comes up with stories and theories about what this means and what that means. And sometimes there is no meaning to any of it. It's a red herring. It's meant to throw people off. You know, you may well be right, but I'm going to stick to my guns and say that Chris Jericho is coming back on January 2nd. I don't care what the guy says. The guy said he's going to be in Hawaii, and so therefore it will be impossible for him to appear in Memphis on January 2nd. Not impossible. First of all, he could be blowing smoke up our ass, and second of all, he may well be in Hawaii that day, and then he flies into Memphis. I'm going to stick to my guns. Chris Jericho's coming back on January 2nd. If it's The Undertaker, well, I will give you your props, but I have a feeling that you are wrong, my friend. Got a question here from somebody who did not include their name. You have to include your name in these emails when you send them to me. First question here, what's the heat between Shane Douglas and WWE? Shane Douglas has heat with everybody. Shane Douglas has heat with Ric Flair. Shane Douglas has heat probably with his own mother. The heat with WWE stems from when he was Dean Douglas in 1995. He fell victim to political shenanigans from the clique. He was not very well liked by the clique backstage, and he feels they helped sabotage his run there, and never did come back to WWE after that, I don't believe. So that's where the heat with them stems from. As far as his second question here, why do wrestling fans refer to Rick Steiner as mentally challenged? Did you ever see a Rick Steiner promo back in the day? That might give you a little bit of insight into why people say that. I myself have never called Rick Steiner mentally challenged. I may have called the people who book wrestling shows mentally challenged, but I myself have never called Rick Steiner mentally challenged, so I cannot answer for that. Ernest writes in, two questions here. Whatever happened to Super Crazy from the the ECW and WWF days? Super Crazy, as I understand it, is still wrestling independence. I think he is wrestling down in Mexico. I think he had his head shaved, actually, earlier this year at a show down in Mexico. So he's still wrestling. Second question here, could you review the WWE Vengeance match for Match Anatomy between Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero for the U.S. title back in 2003? We'll see. I remember being a big fan of that match. I thought it was a very good match. I believe it opened the show, and I'd love to review it, but it's been a while since I've actually watched a Chris Benoit match, let alone a match that involved Chris and Eddie. Could be a little tough to do, but I'll put that on my list, and I will consider that as a potential candidate for Match Anatomy going forward. Mosin from Pakistan writes in, was it right of WWE to book The Rock in a match at Survivor Series? He could have just made an appearance and screwed Cena. Would it not have been better to have him make his in-ring comeback at WrestleMania in Miami? Could have given more fans an incentive to buy WrestleMania. Do you think it will have an effect on Mania sales? No, it will not. The same people who are going to buy WrestleMania are going to buy the show regardless. People are not going to not buy WrestleMania because The Rock already wrestled at Survivor Series. Absolutely not. It was a safe thing for WWE to do. They just botched the execution of it. They botched the buildup of it. They made Miz and R-Truth seem like a couple of complete job guys who they were pretending to be intimidating. They were anything but. And, you know, the dynamic of Rock and Cena, even that, I don't think they played that up enough. You know, Cena looked like a neutered little dog, you know, the way that he acted that whole match and after the match. And he was just poorly executed, I guess. But and Survivor Series did not do very well, as we talked about earlier. But to say that it's going to impact WrestleMania sales is a joke. It's not going to take one buy away from WrestleMania, not one. That show is going to do big business no matter what. It's just a matter of how big, you know. Are people underestimating how big the business is going to be? Is it going to be a disappointing number? Even a disappointing number is still probably going to be a very big number for WrestleMania next year. And don't forget, you know, they're going to try to load the show up. You know, if they get Shaquille O'Neal to do a match with Big Show, that'll bring in some curiosity buys. If they promote Undertaker versus Triple H, and you know, the rumor is that they're going to go with the idea of having Shawn Michaels as the guest referee, you know, how they're going to get him in there, I don't know. But, you know, will Shawn screw the Undertaker and end the streak and help his friend, or is he going to not help his best friend? I guess that'll be the storyline going into it. There's the potential for a Chris Jericho CM Punk championship match. You know, the WrestleMania rundown, those top three or four matches could be very big. You know, Rock Cena is going to be the big selling point of the pay-per-view, but there could be more than just Rock Cena that helps sell that show. So WrestleMania is going to do fine no matter what. The fact that Rock wrestled at Madison Square Garden will mean nothing to the WrestleMania buy rate. Marcus from Arkansas writes in, I was tripped out to see the six-man Raw main event get so low in the ratings. I didn't watch Raw, but when I heard about the main event, I just tuned in to give it my rating. Well, it doesn't. Unless you're a Nielsen family, it doesn't exactly work that way. But anyway, why didn't everyone tune in? Love getting the idea of getting future guys going, but what's up with the rating for the main event? Are fans TiVoing? Are there mixed reactions from new and older fans? Is it the C Nation? Or maybe we got it all wrong and today's wrestling fan wants the soapy drama bullshit. What are your thoughts? What do you think today's fans want? In all honesty, I don't think the fans know what they want. I really don't. You know, the internet audience is a vocal audience, but it's not as big of an audience as you may think. You know, the audience that WWE caters to are the kids and the families who come to the shows. A lot of fans out there are probably not even aware that Zack Ryder even has a YouTube show. I know they did a video on Raw a while ago that made reference to it. But I think maybe sometimes we put a little too much stock into the internet wrestling audience and give it a little more influence than it actually has. But you have fans on the internet who ranted and raved for so long that CM Punk should be champion and CM Punk needs to be pushed more. And now CM Punk is the focal point of the company. You know, John Cena is always going to be there. But CM Punk is the WWE champion. You just had a pay-per-view where Punk headlined and John Cena was nowhere to be found. Punk headlined Raw the next night as well. And people still complain. You know? Daniel Bryan is the World Heavyweight Champion. Now, yes, as I said, I question for how long he will hold on to that championship. I've questioned their booking of Daniel Bryan now for months. But I like the fact that they took a chance and put the championship on him. And they didn't take it from him the next night. He didn't have a Christian reign as champion, where he has a couple of days and then they take it off him. Zack Ryder built himself up with that YouTube show. Built up a huge fan following on the internet. Now he's starting to get over a little bit more bit by bit each week with the people, the main people who come to these shows. He's selling more merchandise. They're making more merchandise for him. He's getting himself over. It's a really cool thing to see. The gimmick, I think, only has so much you know, gas to it. He can only go so far with this broski gimmick. If he wants to be taken seriously, at some point that's going to have to change. But I wouldn't change a thing about him right now. He's fine as a mid-card or even an upper mid-card babyface. He's got the U.S. title. He's over. I wouldn't change anything about him right now, but, you know, some people aren't into that. Some people may look at him and go, God, this guy's a fucking joke. This guy's a ripoff of the Jersey Shore, even though I think he was probably doing the gimmick before the Jersey Shore. But what do wrestling fans want? I really don't think wrestling fans know what they want, because when they get what they want, they still manage to complain. I complain about things because, A, I do a show, and I try to look at all angles of it. I'm not just going to come on each week and sing the praises of WWE. If WWE was doing everything right, I'd be more than happy to come on here and sing their praises and then rip apart something else. I rip apart WWE because they're far from perfect. I appreciate that they're finally starting to pull their head out of their ass just a little bit and push some of these newer guys. But that doesn't mean that they're still not doing things that make me want to rip my hair out of my head, and I'm going to call them out on it. But I'm one of these people who I'll give credit where credit is due. I like and support what they're doing right now. But you have people out there, and you can just take a look at the comment sections at SEScoops.com, which is probably the wrong thing to do. That's a bad example to give, given some of the bad apples that hang out there. But you get people who will want something so badly and so passionately. Why doesn't WWE push this guy? Why won't they put the championship on this guy? And when they do, they'll just find something else to complain about. Oh, they made him look so weak. Oh, they're going to take the title off him in 4 days, so who cares? And even me, you know, that negativity sometimes will get me very angry, because I can be as negative as anybody, but I try to be fair about it. I give the company credit when they do something good. And some people just refuse to. Some fans cannot give credit where credit is due to WWE, to TNA, when they do something good. Well, it's just, you know, they got lucky, or it's just for 1 week. You know, next week they're going to fuck it all up. And it's wrestling fans for you. You know, what can you say? You know, they'll always find something to be negative about. I don't know that that's the reason people tuned out in droves. I think people tuned out in droves just because it was something new. To them, Zack Ryder is not a star. Daniel Bryan is not a star. CM Punk is kind of a star, but still people don't look at him the same way they look at a John Cena or even Kane or Triple H. Is it going to take shoving CM Punk down our throats for three or four years to get people to get behind him as a real main eventer, which is what they did with John Cena? You know, people didn't look at John Cena as a main event guy at first, but he was their guy, and they shoved him down our throats year after year after year. And people still hate John Cena, but John Cena, like him or not, he's a main event guy. You know, when he's out there, people know he's the top guy in the company. He's a star. He's a star outside the ring. He's a star on television. People don't look at CM Punk and people like that the same way. It's going to take time. That's my point. WWE needs to take time with this. Be patient. Don't pull the plug so quickly. Those people may be tuning out this week, but I firmly believe that, you know, whether it takes a couple more weeks or a few months, they're going to start tuning in a little bit more and a little bit more, and it just takes time. But wrestling fans are a fickle bunch. I don't know that they know what they want. You can never really make them truly happy. They're a very interesting bunch of people. And, yeah, that's really all I can say about that. There really is no straight answer. Rory writes in, how impressive is Shane McMahon's coast-to-coast finishing move? I was watching the McMahon vs. McMahon Street Fight at WrestleMania 17 and wish I was there to see it. Well, it was even more impressive when I first saw Rob Van Dam do the move in the original ECW before Shane stole it. Luis from Illinois writes in, should WWE have retired both the Vengeance and Night of Champions pay-per-view names due to their relation to the Benoit tragedy, as there has been no over-the-edge pay-per-view since the Owen Hart accident? I don't see where one has to do with the other. You know, Owen Hart died on pay-per-view at an event called Over the Edge. I think it makes a little bit of sense for them to retire that name, but for Vengeance and Night of Champions, I don't really get the significance. Benoit didn't die at the show, so I don't see why you would retire either one. I think that would be pretty stupid. Second question here, do you think Tribute to the Troops is little more than a PR move by WWE, or is it a genuine attempt to fill the gap of the annual Bob Hope military entertainment trips during the holidays, which ceased after he died in 2003? It's a PR move, through and through. It's a nice thing for them to do. But much as Vince McMahon told Congress a couple of years ago when they asked him about the wellness policy, in the words of Vince McMahon himself, PR. That's all it is. Last question here comes from Carlos. He's been a fan of the Sound Off since episode 176. He says he's absolutely in love with the podcast. With The Rock and John Cena's WrestleMania match coming up, I'm still not very sure why The Rock dislikes Cena so much. I know Cena talked trash about The Rock behind his back, but is there another main reason that Rock dislikes Cena? Is it because Cena's stale PG character is the top star of WWE? Let's make one thing clear first. If we're talking reality here and not storyline, The Rock does not hate John Cena. The Rock and John Cena get along just fine. The legitimate heat that they once had stemmed from an interview. Actually, it was several interviews that John Cena did back in like 2007, 2008, where he would mention The Rock's name and how he wishes The Rock would come back. He doesn't give back and this and that. But really, it was that one interview that he did when he was in the UK in January of 2008. This would have been just a couple of weeks before Cena made his big surprise comeback in the Royal Rumble, which he won. And Cena, and it was an audio interview. I don't know where you would find the audio now. I guess you can go to the UK Sun website. But he did this interview and made these comments about The Rock. You know, why can't he just come back, you know, to do a 15... They had just done the Raw 15-year anniversary show the month before. Even Hulk Hogan, I believe, was on that show. And The Rock wasn't, and Cena was like, why can't he come back, and why can't he come back and just do a 15-year anniversary show and come back and do the eyebrow and, you know, get out of town. And Cena made a comment in that interview, and he said, he used the F word, and I played the audio here on the Sound Off. This was probably episode 17, if I remember correctly. And he said, don't fuck me and tell me that you love this when you're really just doing this to do something else. The insinuation being that, you know, don't lie to me that you love wrestling so much when in reality you're just doing wrestling so you can then move on to do movies and leave wrestling behind. And when Rock heard those comments, you know, and it was fairly hurtful to him, and he felt pretty slighted by those comments, because The Rock really does love wrestling. His family's been a part of the wrestling business forever. And it's not as though when Rock got into wrestling, his goal was to do so well that he would then move on to Hollywood and be a big star. Nobody, when Rock first debuted as Rocky Maivia, believe me, nobody looked at him and thought, wow, this guy's going to be a big movie star one day. He's such a great talker, and he's this and he's that. I mean, a lot of people thought that he had the potential to be a very big star, Pat Patterson being one of those people, Jim Cornette being another. But he came in, he became a much bigger star than anybody I think ever could have imagined. And he parlayed that into a career in Hollywood, which, by the way, a lot of wrestlers have tried doing that, and they failed. Roddy Piper had some success. Hulk Hogan had no success. The Rock is really the only guy to ever really break through and become a bona fide Hollywood movie star. And the issue with Rock and WWE goes back to when his contract expired at the end of 2004. You know, The Rock was already thinking of ideas on what he could do and who he could face at WrestleMania 21 the next year. And then his contract quietly expired. The company never bothered to renew it. They never contacted him to renegotiate a new deal. And he was pissed off, and rightfully so. He was pissed off about that. And so, therefore, you know, WWE was on his shit list for a while. He didn't want to have anything to do with them. I know the stories went around at the time after Eddie Guerrero died that Rock was also pretty unhappy with the way they had handled creative in the wake of his death. That was when they had the storyline with Randy Orton and Rey Mysterio and, you know, Eddie's in hell. And they actually made a storyline in some ways out of Eddie Guerrero's death. And Rock was had no desire to be part of a product that was doing that at the time. But so there was a period where Rock and WWE were not on the best of terms, but that didn't have anything to do with John Cena. And Cena started making these comments, most likely at the behest of Vince McMahon. That's the thing, and it was probably Vince that pushed him to do it. It wasn't as though Cena was talking from the heart. Cena was basically told by Vince McMahon, look, when you do these interviews, mention The Rock's name and let's try to get his attention. Maybe we can get him in to do a match. And instead, it just pissed The Rock off even more. But whatever heat there may have been with Rock and Cena has washed away. You know, what you see on television, it's part of the story. It's part of the build-up to their match at WrestleMania. And yeah, I just wanted to clear that up because there are people who think that there's still legitimate heat between the two of them and that Rock hates Cena's guts. If Rock hated John Cena's guts, he wouldn't be willing to work with him and make money with him. Believe you me. So anyway, that's the deal with Rock and Cena. And that's going to do it for a much bigger mailbag here than I expected to do. A monster mailbag here on the Christmas show. I'm going to cinch this bad boy up here. And if you have any questions, you can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. Questions, comments, compliments, death threats, all that kind of stuff, you can email me there. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/solemonster, facebook.com/thesolemonster. And you can subscribe in iTunes to this show by typing in the name. And you can subscribe to my YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com, whatever the URL is. My username on there is thesolemonster. And you can subscribe there. Anytime a new video goes up, you will be the first to be notified of such. And if you are part of all these different things, you then become officially a part of the Fantastic Four. And who doesn't want to be part of the Fantastic Four now? Come on. So anyway, that's going to do it for episode 198, the Christmas show, Hanukkah show, Kwanzaa show. It's the holiday show. Celebrate all types of holidays here on The Sound Off. We discriminate against no one. But today is Christmas Day, so I do call it the Christmas show. We'll be back next week with episode 199. We are getting perilously close here to 200. And by the way, I spent about 6 hours last night after procrastinating for many, many weeks. I finally have all but finished the intro to episode 200, which is going to be coming up, obviously, very shortly. And this thing's going to be epic. This is going to be good. I think you guys are going to like it. And anyway, episode 199 next week, just so you know, I am thinking of doing a little bit of a look back at the top 5 or maybe top 10 most important matches or things in WWE from 2011, some sort of look back at the year. I'm jotting down some notes and getting my thoughts together, so I may do that. I may lead off with that next week on episode 199. That will be the New Year's show. I don't know if it'll be out on Saturday or Sunday. I guess next Sunday is New Year's Day, I believe. So this could very well be officially the last show of 2011. But next weekend will be the New Year's show, and we'll talk about the year 2011, at least in terms of WWE. And the march to 200 continues. We're going to hit 200 a lot sooner than I thought because of those bonus shows I did a couple of weeks ago. So, again, I have all you guys to thank for it. We wouldn't be approaching 200 episodes if it wasn't for your support. We've got a lot of new listeners. We've got a lot of loyal listeners that have been here from day one. I appreciate you all equally. And your continued support. Keep spreading the word to your family and friends and significant others and people you hate, people you like. Let them know about the show. I think they may enjoy it. Until next time, be well, stay safe. If you celebrate, do have a very Merry Christmas. Happy Kwanzaa. Enjoy the final few days of Hanukkah. And we will see you back here for the New Year's edition of The Sound Off right here next weekend on SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.